Thank you very much for coming this evening. Thank you very much also to the organisers of the festival for asking me to come from London. This is a very beautiful but very hot city. And this is the fourth shirt that I've worn today. How your men manage to look so cool, I really don't understand. But then this is an occasion to speak about conspiracies, and I think maybe there's some form of conspiracy at work here. Either that or there's some kind of genetic secret to it. I'm David Aronovich. The book that I've written, this book, Voodoo Histories, is in essence a history of modern conspiracy theories. It attempts to answer what it is about a conspiracy theory or conspiracy theories that so attracts people that they are prepared to believe a very improbable thing rather than to believe a probable thing. I'm just going to wait for that whistle to die down. So that essentially is what the book looks at. And I spent 6 years looking at all kinds of conspiracy theories. Many more, until I think by the end of the process, I was actually completely mad. I had myself delve so far into conspiracy theories that I was in danger of thinking that there was a conspiracy theory of conspiracy theorists who were planning to deprive me of my sanity by inventing new conspiracy theories so that I could never finish the book. It's a form of mind that you can easily get into. The reason why I became interested in conspiracy theories was that I was in Tunisia working for the BBC briefly in the year 2002. And I went there with a very nice young director cameraman who was a very sensible man. We had to do some filming that was quite difficult and slightly dangerous because, as you know, there was an authoritarian regime and we were trying to look at what was happening to dissidents under that regime in a country which, on the face of things, had a fantastic tourist appeal for the people of Britain and Europe. Anyway, so he was a very sensible man. And we had to undertake some long journeys during the course of this visit. And it was on one of these journeys, as we drove down from the capital city of Tunis to an amphitheatre at a place called El Jem, and for any of you who've seen the film Gladiator, some of the scenes from Gladiator take place in this particular amphitheatre. And it was a long drive. And in the middle of this long drive, where we had had many topics of conversation, this very clever young man said to me, "You know," he said, "about the American landings on the moon." And I said, "Yes, of course I know. When I was very small, I saw them on the television." And he said to me, "No, you didn't." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, let me tell you," he said, "that there is evidence that there was no moon landing," he said. And he then proceeded to give me what he called his evidence. There were some aspects like, from the photographs on the moon, you could see no stars. But if you were on the moon, you would have seen many stars. The flag that the astronauts planted on the moon seemed to wave in the breeze, but on the moon, there is no breeze. That shadows on the moon seem to be coming from several sides at once, casting shadows in different directions. But everyone knows that this is impossible, and so on. There are about 5 examples like this. And then at the end of this, he looked at me with a big kind of smile that people usually use when they've told you a conspiracy theory that they like. And it's kind of like this. I know something, and now we're in on it together. And he said, "What do you think of that?" And I said, well, look, Kevin was his name. Well, Kevin, I don't know about your specific evidence, but it seems to me that it would be more difficult to organise a hoaxed moon landing than to organise a real one. In a real moon landing, all you need are some rockets and the technology to get there and to send the people there, and sometimes it will go wrong and sometimes it will go right and so on. But in a false moon landing, you're going to have to get 40,000 people to lie for the rest of their lives, and all of them in the same way, and they must never forget that they've got to lie, never. And I said, I just can't imagine any group of human beings easily behaving like that. And then I told him some other things. I said, and also, I remember, he was younger than me, he still is younger than me, I remember that there was a movie based on just such a story, a movie called Capricorn 1, in which there's going to be a Mars landing, and the astronauts go and they sit in the rocket, and the capsule at the top of the rocket, and it goes 10, 9, etc. And when it gets to about 5, all of a sudden the door of the capsule is opened, and these men all in black pull them out. The rocket goes up, but they don't, and they're taken to a film studio where they film their landing on Mars several months later. And then, but in the movie, they escape because they don't want to tell a lie for the rest of their lives, and they're pursued across the desert by black helicopters. In fact, there was one earlier today coming over here. Those of you who are at Bee's Talk will remember a black helicopter going overhead. What I think was really nice was that one of the astronauts who was pursued by the helicopters was actually played by O.J. Simpson. So in playing out in film life what he'd later play out in real life. If it's uncomfortable down there, please come and sit up with me. And so that's what I said to him. But then I started to think, why would you want to believe that the moon landings were not real? Why would you rather, but why, what would be, what is the fun in this? And in other conspiracy theories, some conspiracy theories which I believe myself. I mean, my entire generation of British and American middle class professionals were brought up to believe that John F. Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy. Everybody believed it. Woody Allen made jokes about it. That's how you knew it must be true. Everybody who was sensible believed it to be true. But with some of these other conspiracy theories, what was it about them that made them so attractive? Now, I want to concentrate at the beginning of this talk, at this point in the talk, with the first conspiracy theory that I started investigating. Largely because it was the conspiracy theory that may have had itself the most effect upon what then happened to people. It's a conspiracy based on a publication called The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. Essentially, a publication that is about a Jewish conspiracy to take over the world. This was also published in Latin America, certainly in Brazil and Argentina, may well have been published in Colombia as well. In essence, after the First World War, this pamphlet began to, a small book, began to circulate right the way around Europe and in America as well. It was about 80 pages long. As one commentator wrote, since the autumn of 1919, a remarkable book has been circulating in Germany, the civilized countries of Europe and America. And this book was called in German, Die Geheimnisse der Weisen von Zion, in English, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. About 80 pages, which claimed to be a record of a meeting of the top Jewish leaders, whoever they were supposed to be, at the time of the first World Zionist Congress in Basel, in Switzerland, in 1897. So you have the Congress in Baal, and then, which is in open, and then you have this secret supposed meeting which happens alongside it. And in this meeting, these elders discuss how they are going to take over the world. And their plan is a very particular one. What they're going to do is they're going to take over the political parties. Not just some of the political parties, all the political parties, the conservative parties, the liberal parties, the socialist parties, the anarchist parties, if you can have parties as an anarchist. They're going to take them over. They're going to take over the trades unions. They're going to take over the employers' organisations. They are even, and this is a particularly good job, I would have thought, they're even going to be responsible for subverting the morals of the women of the world. Of all the jobs that they're given, I thought that was probably the one I would have wanted myself. The others are being a bit sort of more serious. And then I'll just read you a quote from what they're saying about the about taking over newspapers. It says, "Literature and journalism are two of the most important educative forces, and therefore our government," this is the Jewish world government, "will become proprietor of the majority of the journals. This, however, must in no wise be suspected by the public. All journals published by us will be of the most opposite in appearance, tendencies and opinions, thereby creating confidence in us and bringing over to us our quite unsuspicious opponents, who will thus fall into our trap and be rendered harmless. All our newspapers will be of all possible complexions, aristocratic, republican, revolutionary, even anarchical." And then this phrase, "Like the Indian pagan god Vishnu, they will have 100 hands, and in each shall beat the pulse of a different intellectual tendency." So this big, big plan is in this pamphlet, which is circulated right the way through Europe. It's circulated in Germany, where it becomes a very important document in the hands of the early people who then become the members of the Nazi Party. It's circulated in France, where it becomes an important document underpinning the far right in France. It's circulated in Britain. In Britain, it even gets an editorial in The Times. Now, this is a very important thing in Britain, an editorial in The Times. Speaking as a journalist who writes myself for The Times, it's still a very important thing to get an editorial in The Times. It has a degree of authority, which is very important. So this is what the editor of The Times wrote when this pamphlet was circulated in England. The editorial was titled, "A Disturbing Pamphlet, A Call for Inquiry." What are these protocols? Are they authentic? If so, what malevolent assembly concocted these plans and gloated over their exposition? Can I just apologize for a moment for the archaic English in that particular phrase? There was a style of writing in editorials that wasn't used anywhere else in the English language, and that's an example of it. It's what we call pompous. It still is, by and large. And then it asks, are they a forgery? If so, whence comes the uncanny note of prophecy? Prophecy in parts fulfilled, in parts far gone in the way of fulfillment. Have we been struggling these tragic years of the years of the First World War, to blow up and extirpate the secret organization of German world domination, only to find beneath it another more dangerous because more secret? Have we, by straining every fiber of our national body, escaped a Pax Germanica, only to fall into a Pax Judaica? This, as you can imagine, alarmed the relatively small population of Jewish people in Britain. And it was a theme taken up by many of the other newspapers in Britain, particularly the more conservative ones, who said there must be an inquiry. It's possible that this document which says these things is really true. And if so, it could help explain why we got into the First World War and why so many people died and so on. Now, One year later, the Times correspondent in Constantinople, a man called Philip Graves, had a meeting with a Russian exile, what they call a white Russian, somebody who'd escaped from the Bolshevik Revolution. And this man gave him a book he brought with him from Russia. It was a book published in Brussels in 1864, and it was called Dialogues Between Montesquieu and Machiavelli in Hell. So not a very snappy, you know, populist sort of thing, rather difficult book. Essentially what it was a satire on the reign of Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, who was emperor of the French at the time. This is the great Napoleon's not-so-great nephew. If you remember, he was the person who sparked Marx's favourite phrase of history repeating itself twice, the first time as tragedy and the second as farce. Louis Napoleon Bonaparte was the farce. This document included this phrase. Many such phrases, but I'll just read you one of them because you might recognise it. In it, Machiavelli, this is published in 1864, is discussing how he should deal with the press. And Machiavelli says, I shall count on devoted journals in each party. I shall have an aristocratic one in the aristocratic party, a republican one in the republican party, a revolutionary one in the revolutionary party, an anarchist one, if necessary, in the anarchist party. And then, like the god Vishnu, my press will have 100 arms, each hand of which will feel the nuances of public opinion. Well, you can see the trick here fairly simply. Somebody had taken this book, The Dialogues Between Machiavelli and Montesquieu in Hell, published in Paris, in Brussels in 1860, had taken large sections of it, changed it round to look as if it was Jews, and then published it as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. In other words, it was a fairly simple and straightforward forgery. As it happens, it was a forgery that was put out by the Russian secret police in Paris in the 1890s as part of their own internal battle against liberals during the course of the Tsarist regime. But, despite the fact that Philip Graves published this three-part article in the Times, after which it was known that the Protocols of the Elders of Zion were untrue, they continued to be circulated in most of the countries of Europe and in America. Henry Ford, the industrialist, was a major supporter of circulating the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. He believed that the Jews were taking over Hollywood, were taking over music hall and so on. He had a long article in his newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, complaining about Irving Berlin. And how Irving Berlin had reduced the American musical industry, which I think is an argument that doesn't really stand up very much to history. So it was pretty clear that it was a forgery. This is Hitler in Mein Kampf, writing about the forgery in 1923. The extent to which the whole existence of the people, this is the Jews, is based on a continual lie, is shown in an incomparable manner in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which the Jews hate so tremendously. The Frankfurter Zeitung is forever moaning to the people that they are supposed to be a forgery, which is the surest proof, writes Hitler, that they are genuine. And there you have almost the perfect expression of a certain kind of conspiracy theorist notion that the more somebody like me argues that they're not true, the more it proves that they must be true, because otherwise why would we be saying it? That the protocols have been disproved and been proved to be a forgery, and actually, of course, they were ludicrous anyway. They were ludicrous before they were proved to be a forgery. It was a ludicrous thing to imagine. And we'll come on to a moment into why people might believe the ludicrous thing. But first, let's notice that many people continue to believe it despite the evidence that it was indeed a forgery. Many people continue to believe it to this day. Reference to the Protocols of the Elders of Zion are in the Hamas Charter currently, which is, and I interviewed one of their leaders about it in Gaza in 2004. It's widely believed on Iranian television and by Iranian academics. You'll even get, Iranian film experts getting on Iranian television to tell you how American movies are made in accordance with the protocols of the Elders of Zion. I don't know whether the film Meet the Fockers was very popular here in Colombia, and I don't know how that title translated and whether it conveyed quite some of the what we call the double entendre in French that it conveys in English. But anyway, on Iranian television, you could get a professor from Tehran University showing very seriously how the character of Ben Stiller in Meet the Fockers is cunningly supposed to represent Jews, and the film is so cunningly created as to make you sympathetic to Jews. In other words, it's all a plot. If you believe in a kind of conspiracy at that level, it's a bit like whoever is behind this tree here believing that the tree was deliberately planted so that he wouldn't be able to see me during the course of this talk. That's essentially what a conspiracy theory gone mad is. There are plenty of Americans who believe that Barack Obama is not American, that he was not born in Hawaii, he was born somewhere else. Now, there is a problem with this theory. The problem with this theory is that his birth was recorded at the time in the advertisement columns of two Honolulu newspapers. So they would have to believe that they had known at the time that he was likely to become an important person and decided that despite the fact he had been born at the same time in Kenya or somewhere else, they would put these advertisements in the Honolulu papers. There are people who believe this, okay? And so there were people who continued to believe in the protocols of the Elders of Zion. I want to give you just one example of how that had an effect. There's a very good book in English called In Bad Faith by a writer, Carmen Khalil. And it's a story about the story of the life of somebody called Louis Daquier de Pellepoix, who was a French, what you would call a boulevardier. Essentially, the kind of man who with his wife, would live in hotel after hotel, running up a big bill, and then as soon as they called the police, running off to live in a different one. That's essentially the kind of man he was. He had no money ever, but he always lived well. He was essentially what we call a con man, a confidence trickster. And he believed nothing, Daquier de Pellepoix. His name wasn't even de Pellepoix. He just added that bit so that he could sound aristocratic. But in the 1930s, he got politics. He became a member of the French far right. But there was only one book he ever read, and it was Protocols of the Elders of Zion. When Germany invaded France, it split France into two parts in 1940. The German occupied zone around Paris and Vichy France, based on the town of Vichy, a separate government. Louis Daquier de Pellepoix became a member of the Vichy government. Specifically, he became the Commissioner for Jewish Affairs of the Vichy government. And in that capacity, organized the transportation of French Jews to Auschwitz. He wouldn't, I think, have done that if he hadn't believed in the protocols of the learned Elders of Zion. In other words, if he hadn't been a convinced conspiracy theorist. Now, that's one very big example of a conspiracy theory, and we can think of many others. I was asked in an interview by a very good Colombian journalist how many Latin American conspiracies I dealt with, and I had to say none. I don't deal with any South American conspiracy theories in my book, though I gather that there are very many South American conspiracy theories. As it was, it took me 6 years because there are so many conspiracy theories and so on. But I want to illustrate to you one quality that conspiracy theories have, which is the desire that people have to believe something, just the desire, and how the desire for it motivates the belief. And that is the case of Princess Diana, the Princess of Wales. In other words, our own, in England, homegrown conspiracy theory. Now, are you broadly familiar with Princess Diana? did her fame reach so far into Colombia that you all got fed up with her as we did in Britain? Had you had enough? She was, of course, what we call an iconic figure. I've defined an iconic figure as somebody you can recognize from the back as well as from the front. If you think about icons, that generally, it generally works as a rule. She was, of course, a very important person. And she died in a car accident. Or did she? Now, for a conspiracy, Princess Diana's death is a not a very promising example, and I'll tell you why. It's really simple. On that night, at the end of August 1997, Princess Diana and her lover, Dodi Al-Fayed, were in the Ritz. They were going to go somewhere else. Nobody knew where they were going. They only decided at the last minute. Nobody knew which car they were taking. That was decided by Mohammed Al-Fayed at the last minute. Nobody knew which driver they were using. Mohammed Al-Fayed decided that at the last minute as well. Nobody knew, therefore, which route they would be taking. Actually, they didn't take the most likely route there. So it would have been extraordinarily difficult for anybody to organize the complex road accident which they would have had to have somehow manufactured in order to kill her by conspiracy. Not only that, but if Princess Diana had done one thing, she would not have died. What is that one thing? I'm inviting you to answer my question. Yeah, wore a seatbelt. If she had worn her seatbelt, she wouldn't have died. So firstly, you would have had to have organized the most incredibly difficult and complicated conspiracy. And secondly, your entire conspiracy would have been defeated if the woman had just put her seatbelt on. It's not very credible. In fact, it's incredible. But in the weeks and months after her death, the conspiracy theories started to grow. Somebody had seen a blinding light, and maybe, somebody else said, this blinding light was linked to the kind of blinding light that possibly British intelligence had maybe been thinking about to use in an assassination attempt, which was never made, on Slobodan Milosevic. Then there was the question of the Fiat Uno, which hit the Mercedes very slightly, and so on. And there was the argument that maybe this Fiat Uno was used to help the accident happen. Now, I don't know how many of you are drivers of Mercedes and how many are drivers of Fiat Unos, but if you were going to use a car to sideswipe a Mercedes so that it had a crash, you would not use a Fiat Uno. You really would not. You'd use something a little more substantial. In fact, the Fiat Uno may be the best example of the car you would not use in order to do it. Nevertheless, we had documentaries looking at these strange and disturbing questions. We had senior journalists saying that there was something very suspicious about it, and they thought there should be a big investigation. We had, at one stage, one third of the British people who believed that there was a conspiracy. So now the question arises, why did some people want there to be a conspiracy? Why was the conspiracy, for them, a more satisfactory explanation than an accident? Well, in many ways, accidents and coincidences are very unsatisfactory stories for us as human beings. We are always looking for additional causality, for the real, the underlying, the real causes of things. We do this all the time. We do it with regard to our health. We're always looking for a story as to why we get this cold or this flu or something like that. It doesn't matter if it bears no relationship to reality. There are plenty of people who will say, I caught a cold that day I went out without my coat on. No, you can't catch a cold by going out without your coat on. That's not how colds work, unfortunately. But we will nevertheless do it. How often have you heard somebody say, maybe not in Cartagena, but certainly in London, it always rains on my birthday? Okay. It always happens to me. Ah, how about this, if you're football lovers? Referees always hate my team. Okay? In other words, we have a whole series of explanations, from very small ones, that we give to the everyday events in our lives in order to make them less accidental, to make them less contingent, and to make them more planned. A conspiracy theory has the advantage of suggesting that somebody has always planned something. Somebody intended for this thing to happen. Somebody intended the crash to happen. Somebody intended that the man over there, who I can't see because of the tree, shouldn't be able to see me this evening. He always gets the chair behind the tree, and so on. He may think, or I may think, how does the microphone never work whenever I'm on stage, or something like that. You know, in other words, we have thousands of such things that we tell ourselves. Another aspect of conspiracy theory is often thought is what we might describe as the, and it was described this way by a famous American intellectual and historian, Richard Hofstadter, writing in the 60s, when he talked about the paranoid style in American politics. And you get a lot of this talk at the moment in American politics about paranoia and what paranoia is, the belief that somebody is out to get you, the wrong belief that somebody is out to get you. Is paranoia a satisfactory explanation of a belief in conspiracy theories? Well, yes, it may be. If you understand paranoia like this, and a psychoanalyst friend of mine put it to me like this, and I thought it was very interesting. He said that often paranoia comes from people whose biggest worry is that, in fact, nobody cares about them at all. In other words, if you get an old person who's on their own, maybe a widow or a widower, who starts to say, I think somebody's been coming into my apartment and moving things, are they not really saying that in a strange way they hope somebody has been coming into their apartment and moving things? Because isn't the worst truth that no one has been coming into their apartment and moving things because nobody cares? And my friend described this as the catastrophe of indifference. Susan Sontag also had a phrase she used. She said she envied paranoiacs or paranoid people because they always believe that somebody's thinking about them. That's the condition of the paranoid. Or, it's a sort of variant on Oscar Wilde's very famous dictum, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about, and so on. In other words, if there is a conspiracy theory, then we are always in somebody's mind. We always exist, or the world always exists to be planned by somebody or other. And I'm going to use another example to illustrate what I mean, which is the conspiracy theory that I believed in for a long time, not because I thought about it very much, but as I said, everybody I knew did, which is the death of John F. Kennedy. Now, there have been hundreds, thousands of books written about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Just about every organization that has ever existed in human endeavor has been blamed for the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The KGB, the CIA, MI5 and MI6, the FBI, the Mafia, of course, and many other organizations beside, even the Jews and the Freemasons and so on. It becomes every kind of theory that there is. Now, essentially, there were very few facts which suggested a conspiracy other than, if you like, some ideas that one of the bullets that hit John Kennedy and then Governor Connolly in that car as it went slowly down Dealey Plaza that day in November 1963, that this shot was impossible. In fact, using computer reconstruction and timing from audio tape, it is not just possible, it is the likely shot. And also, when you know that Lee Harvey Oswald, the assassin, had actually tried to kill somebody only that spring, only a few months earlier, 6 months earlier, and had narrowly missed, you know, understand that he already was the type of man who would do this. So there needs to be no very great explanation for the death of John F. Kennedy. In other words, it's all fairly easily understandable. But for so many years now, people have wanted to believe or have believed in the conspiracy theory. When I went back to 1963 to look at what people had written in the immediate aftermath of Kennedy's death, something became apparent to me, which I hadn't realized before because I was too young when it happened. And that was the degree to which the single gunman theory was itself incredibly upsetting to Americans back in 1963. It was itself paralyzing. Because what it said to them is, we are the kind of country which manufactures people like Lee Harvey Oswald, who can be so dangerous that they can actually kill a popular president. How have we become such a nation? And actually, you saw something very similar after Jared Lochner shot Congresswoman Giffords in Arizona a few weeks ago. It was very much the same kind of feeling. How have we become the kind of place, how have we given rise to the kind of discourse that allows somebody or encourages somebody to an act like this? Actually, single gunman assassinations in American history were not that uncommon. They'd happened several times before. But by 1963, it would become, if you like, a scar on America's post-war psyche, this immensely prosperous and in many ways very confident nation, having to ask itself how such a thing had come about. Now, I'm just going to try and take note of the time. I haven't got a watch up here, so if anybody could advise me of what the time is. Are we at 20 to 8 yet? At 7:40? Sorry? We're at 10 past 8. It's 10 past 8 now. Oh, yes, of course it would be. Yeah, that's fine. Right, in that time, it's time for... Excellent, I'd misplaced half an hour. In that case, I'm just going to quickly finish up on this bit to say that I've written not just about the conspiracy theories that matter, but also some of the conspiracy theories that don't matter at all, what we call pseudo-archaeology and pseudo-history, because one of the things that offended me very slightly was the idea that ridiculous notions, such as the Catholic Church covering up the secret bloodline of Christ, should sell more books than really good books by good historians. It doesn't kill anybody, but it's very, what we call in English, annoying. It's very annoying, it's offensive, and so on. So there are other conspiracy theories which are nothing like as important as these conspiracy theories. But the more I look around at the world at the moment, the more I think that there are a series of extremely troubling conspiracy theories out there that actually do have an impact on the way in which people think. In Pakistan and Iran and so on, conspiracy theories about America, about Israel, about the Jews and so on, are so prevalent that actually it's nearly impossible to get even the intelligentsia in those countries ever to believe or to understand how some of these events are caused. And there's a real problem when a complete and important strata of a society carries in its head a false notion of what's happening. Sometimes it can be ludicrous, sometimes it can be very important, such as the belief, which is very widespread in these countries, that President Bush himself was responsible for bringing down the Twin Towers on 9/11. So what I would say as I come to the end of this is that actually I understand, as everybody else does, that there's a lot of pleasure to be had from conspiracy theories. There's a lot of pleasure to be had, as there is in any thriller. Most thrillers are based on a conspiracy theory of some sort, something so improbable, made to sound probable, that you enjoy it. But a lot of these conspiracy theories actually in the end turn out to be quite damaging and require quite a lot of work to correct. I'm going to stop now, and I'm going to invite you to ask questions or to say anything you've got to say. I think there are some microphones, if you could show. Yeah, there's one microphone here and one microphone there. These fans at the front are very noisy, so it doesn't matter how loud you shout. If you don't use the microphone, I won't hear you. The people around you will hear you, and if they do and you don't use the microphone, they can answer your question. But I won't be able to hear you. So if anybody would like to start us off, it's always the first question is the toughest. Yes, there's a gentleman with glasses there who's very diffidently putting his hand up.
Hi.
Yeah, it's working.
Have you ever come across a conspiracy theory?
And the funny thing is that usually when people do this, the microphone is working, and then they think it's not working and they turn it off, and then it doesn't work.
Have you ever come across a conspiracy theory you found actually credible, increasingly so, and started sort of to consume you?
Did you ask me, did I ever come across a conspiracy theory I did believe in after I'd looked at it? Yeah. The reason why I thought that was the question you asked is because that's the question I get asked every single time I do one of these. Usually by somebody looking rather hopeful, as if to say, please, is there a conspiracy theory you do believe? I'm not saying that's what you said, but there are conspiracies. People do things in secret. And there are lies, and people lie. My daughters... One of my daughters, or two of my daughters, lie to me all the time. I, however, always tell the truth back. You can see from the way I look that I'm a very truthful person. We lie in order to do the things that we think are necessary. And sometimes these lies can be slightly complicated. But what a conspiracy theory is, by and large, and we all know about Watergate, for instance, which was a conspiracy. But let's look at Watergate, for example, as an example of a conspiracy, okay? Because let's imagine that we're writing Watergate the thriller. Watergate hasn't happened, and you're going to write a thriller based on the story of Watergate. And you have a meeting with your publishers, okay? And your publisher says, please, explain to me your thriller. And say, okay, this is what happens. There's a Republican president, and there's an election, and he wants to manipulate this election, and he wants to find out the secrets of his opponents, the Democrats. So, what he does is he organizes a secret team of burglars to go to their offices and break in. And the publisher says, yeah, this is really good. What happens? He says, well, they're just in the office, and they've turned the lights on, they're just opening the drawers, and a security guard comes in. Yeah, and the publisher says, yeah, and what happens then? And he said, well, security guard catches them. Yeah, and then what happens? And the security guard calls the police. Yeah? Yeah, and then they're arrested. And then your publisher says, well, I'm terribly sorry, but that really is a very, very boring thriller. It wouldn't even pass muster for the beginning. That's essentially what happened in Watergate. The rest of it was just Nixon denying that he knew, and what discovered Nixon did know? A tape that he himself had made, but that wasn't wiped out, erased properly. That's almost the nearest thing to a real-life conspiracy in modern Western history. There are actually a couple of others that are better. It's one of the best examples. In other words, complex conspiracy theories are very, very difficult, I think, to organise. Iran-Contra, I think, is probably the best example of one that we know about. At which point, somebody then says, ah, but the really clever conspiracy theory, of course, is the one you don't know about. And I have to concede, it's true. It may very well be that the conspiracy theory that is true, the really complicated one, is the one that I don't know about. You cannot rule it out. But if you go along around life ruling such things in, then you become the kind of person who can't even walk off the pavement to cross the other side of the road. Anybody else? Yes, B.
Yes. I always considered conspiracy theories as something, you know, of the lunatic fringe and never took them very seriously. You've detailed some extremely vicious and harmful events. Instances, rather, of conspiracy theories. I just wonder if you know, has... Can there be a good? Can there be a sense in which, you know, it embodies it's a healthy mistrust of the authorities, for example?
Okay.
You know, can any good come of a conspiracy theory?
Okay. For those of you who didn't hear at the back, the question was, can conspiracy theories be good for us, some of them, in the sense that they question authority? Okay. Again, this is a question I've been asked before. No, but I think it's a very intelligent question. It asks, essentially, what is real scepticism? What is the true habit of scepticism? What does somebody who is really sceptical, not cynical, Cynicism is a different thing. If you say to yourself, the government and politicians all lie, that's cynicism. Because, of course, they don't all lie, but what saying that does is it absolves you of any responsibility. You don't have to listen to the argument because they all lie, takes all responsibility from you. You have none. Okay. So what we're talking about is true skepticism, which is evaluating what people tell you based on the best authority that you can manage. It's a very difficult thing to do because very few of us can be expert in everything. In fact, none of us can be expert in everything. We have to make all kinds of decisions all the time based on the authority of others. Are we going to take those medicines that the doctor recommends? Are we happy with this particular airline into whose hands we have placed our safety and that of our families and so on? We make judgments all the time about trust and who to trust. But we also have to make judgments all the time about whether or not to believe things that we're told. That's a habit of true skepticism. Believing a conspiracy theory, in my opinion, actually pushes you away from the habit of real skepticism. It pushes you into the realm of fantasy and away from the realm of reality and therefore of asking real questions. Let's suppose that you are a person who wants to change things in America. You think things could be different. You want to work for that. But you become convinced that there was a conspiracy on 9/11, that Bush did it in an incredibly complicated way. And you read all these websites and internet things where these people say the same thing. And eventually you become an activist, what they call for 9/11 truth. And like some of the people I've met, you put all your time into arguing about 9/11 and to try to get people to see what you think is the reality. And as a result, you've had no time to look at practical ways for changing the society that you're a part of. I would say that's a complete waste of yours and everybody else's time. They would say different. I've met people, because often people who believe in conspiracy theories are very intelligent people. Conspiracy theories never start with the proletariat or the peasantry. Never. They always start with the educated classes, students, lawyers, academics, and so on. People in this room, we are the great conspiracy theorists, people like us. It will be people like us who believe in conspiracy theories who you might go away from this room to talk to about the discussion that you've had here. It will not be, by and large, it will not be the fishermen out there bringing the fish in and so on. That's not where they tend to begin and believe. Anyway, I've digressed from the question, the very good question you originally asked. Would anybody else like to ask a question? Or indeed, run past me one of their own favourite conspiracy theories and see if I know anything about it. Or, if they would like to, very briefly, tell me a really good Colombian conspiracy theory, because I don't know them. If you're at the back, you would have to wave. There's a chap there, yes.
A really pernicious conspiracy theory that has been going around in your world and ours is the takeover of the Western world by the Islamic conspiracy, where the Netherlands will be half Islamic within 20 years, and Europe, etc., etc., etc. You've seen a lot of that. We've all seen a lot of that. Have you worked on the origins and the reasons for that particular conspiracy theory?
On the origins and the reasons for?
The Islamic takeover of the Western world.
Oh, the Islamic takeover of the Western world. I've never heard of it as a conspiracy theory. In other words, I've never heard that there's a group of mullahs somewhere sitting in, where would they be sitting? Where should we put them? Should we put them in Tehran? Isfahan. Let's put them in Isfahan. None of us have been to Isfahan, so we've all got to imagine what it's like in Isfahan. There is a madrasa in Isfahan. Okay. And in that madrasa in Isfahan, the world's top Islamists have got together. And they said, look, how are we going to get the caliphate? Well, try terrorism. Doesn't really work. It's not very good. We tried conquest, open conquest, back in the days of the Abbasids and the Fatimids and so on. And that quite, you know, that got stopped by Charles Martel in France, and it got stopped, you know, at the gates of Vienna in 1683. I know what we'll do. This is an increasingly globalized world. We will encourage ordinary Muslims from Pakistan and Somalia to go, and Turkey. What will actually, even better, we will get the Germans to invite the Turkish Muslims to come over. So we will plant somebody in Germany, in the West German ministry, to invite them. And what we'll do is we'll get them all to come over, and we will outbreed the Christians. We'll have more children by them, and it will take about 900 years. But after 900 years, we will be in the majority, and we can then vote a caliphate in, and nobody will be against us. No, I haven't heard that conspiracy theory. No, but it's a good one. It's a quite a nice one, and we could, you know, and it's lurid, and there are people who will believe it. Yeah, there are people who will believe it. Other people will believe simply that, say, in the case of Britain, we have 1.5 million Muslims in Britain, mostly because they have come from countries that were formerly colonies of Britain. That's why. There's no great mystery about it. Some have come, like Somalis, because they have sought refugee status in Britain. But most have come from former colonies of the United Kingdom. And most Muslims are in Europe as a result of, not a conspiracy, but as a result of colonialism. It's really quite simple. And now, of course, the movement of peoples is very, very difficult to stop. It's incredibly difficult. I'm glad it's difficult to stop. Other people are not glad. I'm very glad that people move around. I come from London, which is now an international city. And if I go to other cities in England, I feel that they are boring by comparison. Truthfully, I do. Even the city of York seems boring compared with London. You see, there's somebody from York here. I knew that. Any other questions? Yes. Person in the white shirt. If there's somebody at the back with a question, I can hardly see you, but there must be somebody at the back who would like to ask a question. Or maybe none of you have been able to hear back there for the whole of the last hour, and you think that you've been listening to a recital by a master musician. You just couldn't hear the notes properly. It's possible. Yeah.
What do you think of Julian Assange and his WikiLeaks and this conspiracy theory?
The question was what I think about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. I actually debated with Julian Assange in London at the end of September and found him a very interesting and very peculiar man. He is a representative of the New World, essentially. He's a representative in extreme form of the world that is coming. And WikiLeaks is a representative in an extreme form of the world that is being born. It's a world of incredible information, incredible transparency, of very low levels of privacy. It's a world which has decided by and large that privacy is not important and that secrecy is not important. It is born out of two things. Firstly, is the technological information revolution, which has been an information revolution. It has been one, and it is being one. And secondly, the what we call in English the decline of deference. In other words, the lack of automatic respect given to authority and institutions. By and large, in the 1950s, the church, the state, certain leading figures, the political parties commanded respect. If you were working class, you supported the Labour Party and you believed in its leaders. If you were middle class, you tended to support the Conservative Party and you believed in its leaders. Now, in Britain, nobody supports any party automatically and nobody ever believes in the leaders. ever. Or if they do, they only do for about 5 minutes. Everything's changed like that. And Julian Assange is a representative of this. Now, what's funny is that Assange himself doesn't understand that he has a responsibility. And we had this about, and I said, okay, look, why don't you tell us exactly what mechanisms you have for accountability, what you do? And he said, but I'm telling you what I do. I said, no, you don't understand. Why don't you subject yourself to the same scrutiny that you demand the rest of the world is subjected to? Because you are now an authority, Julian. You, Julian Assange, you are now not a little figure, you are now a big and important figure. You must now be accountable. And he did not understand the question. He could not understand it. He just... And then the students in this room, they asked him the same question. They got it. They got they got it, and he didn't. So I think that Julian Assange is a... I hope you understand this word, flawed. He's... there's many things that are good about him, and there are many things that are bad about him. I'm not talking about the accusations made against him. I'm talking about what he represents. But nevertheless, he represents increasingly what is coming. We will and we demand to know everything. Now, the question is what we do with the knowledge, how good we are at dealing with the knowledge we get. That's the big question for the rest of the 21st century, I think. Again, it's a digression, but I think it's important. And there is somebody at the back. Hooray!
What's your view on conspiracy theories relating to climate change?
I heard what's your view on, and then the rest I couldn't quite...
Conspiracy theories and climate change.
Oh, conspiracy theories and climate change, yeah. It's interesting to me that, I mean, essentially, the conspiracy theory on climate change says climate change is not true, it's not happening. It's all been got up by politicians who have arranged for the scientists to make these reports, because if we believe in climate change, then we will do things that the politicians want us to do. And the things we will do is we will pay more taxes and we will submit ourselves to greater authority. And the politicians want us to do this, and they've organised for climate change to be the way of getting us to do it. And they have therefore effectively corrupted scientists to write these things about climate. So that's the climate change conspiracy theory. And like all conspiracy theory, I mean, that conspiracy theory has this additional characteristic, which is that it's optimistic. It's an optimistic conspiracy theory. Because at the end of it, what it says is, if it's all a conspiracy theory, we don't have to do anything. We don't have to do anything. We can carry on just the way we've been carrying on, and nothing will happen to us. Isn't that wonderful? So it's an optimistic conspiracy theory, and arguably one of the most dangerous. I mean, by the time our grandchildren discover whether these people were right or wrong, it could well be too late, or great-grandchildren, but... Anyway, and I don't know, what's the time now? 5:30. We have to stop. I've just got this sort of cutthroat thing. So can I thank you very much for your questions, very much for coming this evening. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.